This is Juliette Kayyem, and from WGBH, this is Security Mom, the podcast about our homeland, unclassified. We all remember where we were in August of 2005 when we watched New Orleans and its citizens drown after Hurricane Katrina. I was 8 months pregnant with my third child, Jeremiah, and by then, so late in the pregnancy and my third one after all, there was nothing exciting about it. So I watched lots of TV, and I watched the images of New Orleans and the Gulf States and what was happening, and I was mad and frustrated and horrified by the government's inability to help people, to save people. I remember one news station had a hovering helicopter, and they focused in on a man and a woman, and she was carrying a child sort of above her shoulders. They were about waist deep in very disgusting water, and he was holding above his head a big box of what were clearly diapers. And the news anchor kept saying, well, we have a problem with public safety. There's all this looting going on. And I'm looking at this family with a child and the box of diapers. I go, that's not looting. That's survival. And it turns out I'm not the only one who was watching with so much frustration and disgust. Also watching was a senior leader in the Coast Guard, then the Coast Guard's chief of staff, Thad Allen. Thad Allen would later end up running, be the commandant of all of the Coast Guard. But at that time, he was just sort of a well-known disaster management expert, someone who had worked in the field and who had a lot of goodwill throughout the federal government. When Hurricane Katrina hit shore and the immediate days after when the levees broke, Thad Allen was just watching on television, too.
The storm came ashore on Monday, the 29th. I actually got the call from Secretary Chertoff on Monday, the 5th of September, which was Labor Day, one week later. In the interim between the storm coming ashore, I, like everybody else in the country, watched in with great frustration the issues with the Superdome, the convention center, and so forth. And it was kind of troubling that we didn't appear to be able to bring together a whole of government response. So when the call came on Monday, the request was for me to go down and become the deputy principal federal official to Mike Brown and focus my efforts in and around New Orleans, where the problems were being identified not only by the press, but the folks who were living down there were very frustrated at what was going on.
So just to remind everyone, Michael Brown was the head of the Federal Emergency Management Agency, who eventually ended his role as the point person in Hurricane Katrina. The famous moment when all of us were watching when President Bush turns to him and says, Brownie, you're doing a heck of a job, would come back over time as you sort of fit into this role and emerge as the leader of the federal efforts. So you're watching really what is safe to say a disjointed, disorganized federal effort, and you head down there. What was the first thing you did? I mean, literally, you're just like, I mean, it seems to me, you know, all hell is breaking loose. How do you even know what to do?
Well, you've got to get on ground and assess the conditions there. After I talked with Secretary Chertoff, I talked to my wife, and we had a discussion about whether or not I should accept the request. A lot of windows to actually fix things there had been closed by what happened at the Superdome and the Convention Center. But in the end, we felt it was the right thing for me to do, to go down there and see what I could do to help. So I was in a plane headed to Baton Rouge. Later on that day, I arrived in Baton Rouge after dark on the 5th. Immediately went to the Emergency Operations Center to see what was going on and be able to talk to Mike Brown. He ended up not being available, and I was scheduled to get a meeting with him first thing in the morning.
At this stage, Mike Brown is leading the effort, and Michael Chertoff and the president send down Thad Allen to essentially assist and be number two. And Brown doesn't have the time to meet with him. In fact, doesn't meet with him till the next day. I suspect Mike Brown knew what was coming.
So in the meantime, I went around and I talked to the folks at the Emergency Operations Center, tried to get a sense for the tempo of operations and what was going on. And then the next morning, I had a very quick meeting with Mike Brown and told him I would head down to New Orleans. And I got in a helicopter in Baton Rouge and flew into New Orleans. And that was my first real exposure, flying in over the city. It was still full of black water. There was no electricity, sewage, or potable water. They were still trying to repair the levees and the drainage canals, which had collapsed because they couldn't pump out the city until they had established a perimeter to keep the water out once they had pumped it out. And that was all going on when I landed.
So at this stage, Michael Chertoff is in Baton Rouge, not the capital of the state, but not where all the activity is going. So the decision essentially to go to New Orleans is a decision to move at least part of the federal resources to, you know, to the fire, essentially.
Well, you're hitting on a key aspect of this, Juliet, that I don't think has been discussed as probably as much as it should be. The rebuttable presumption regarding a natural disaster in this country is that it's a state and local responsibility. Mm-hmm. And under our Constitution, you know, all powers not granted to the federal government are reserved to the states. And the role of the federal government is to provide resources pursuant to a disaster or emergency declaration. And what had happened in the week leading up to my arrival, all of that occurred by doctrine and procedure, everything that was done that should have been done. What was lacking was the ability to bring all those resources that were on the ground together to create a whole of government response or unity of effort. And it's hard to do that unless you're right on ground where it's being impacted.
On the ground. Just remember those words, being on the ground. That is what is so important in a crisis, is that state and local federal responders are in the communities figuring out what's going on, who's where, who needs help, what fire needs to be put out, who needs, you know, clean water or diapers or whatever else. Thad Allen moved the response and the resources and what we call situational awareness, the capacity to know what's going on, directly into New Orleans. And that meant a lot. There was a federal presence there. And it meant a lot just given the politics of the time. Now, Thad Allen is not a political person. He's probably one of the most apolitical people that I know. At the time that Hurricane Katrina hit, President Bush was in Texas on vacation and did not arrive in New Orleans for several days. In fact, he just did a flyover, flying at a couple thousand feet, looking at the disaster and destruction. And he got a lot of criticisms for that. How can the president of the United States not be on the ground? And Thad, responding to the need to see a federal presence in New Orleans, whether it was able to help people or not, just to know that the federal response was there, that is what is so significant about Thad moving from Baton Rouge over to New Orleans.
Because the real problem in New Orleans was they experienced what I thought was an equivalent of a weapon of mass effect used on the city, without criminality, obviously, and they lost continuity of government.
Right. So the normal term in our field is a weapon of mass destruction, a WMD, like a nuclear bomb going off in a city, which would clearly destroy the apparatus, including the political or governmental apparatus. But a weapon of mass effect like Hurricane Katrina sort of had the same impact, which is your normal role would be you're going to work with state and local capacity to buttress it. There was none.
Correct. They had lost their emergency operations center, so their ability to conduct, if you will, command and control, to take those resources and apply them to mission effect was basically decimated and non-existent. So in the week prior to my arrival, there were some extraordinary things done. And, I mean, you have to stand in awe of what the local Coast Guard forces did down there in terms of the aviation and small boat crews that saved over 30,000 people. It was one of the most remarkable operations in Coast Guard history. That said, if you looked at the urban SAR teams and the disaster medical folks that were sent down there, they were all basically reporting back to their own administrative chains of command. They weren't all brought together in a unified way to kind of systematically deal with the problems of the city, and that was the problem. So it was a matter of trying to integrate all those resources on the ground, make them transparent to the needs that were out there, and then apply them to the best use possible against the problems we were able to identify.
So when you describe going down there and then heading to New Orleans, you know, as a, you know, as a father and a husband and a human being, can you just describe to us, like, you know, what you saw? You know, just the it must have just been overwhelming.
Well, yeah, my first reaction was flying in over the city in a Coast Guard helicopter and landing at a makeshift landing zone by the convention center and seeing the Corps of Engineers trying to repair the levees, although the city was still full of black water. Very, very quiet. Odor was very strong. And just the city was just down hard. And it was probably the ability of media to capture that and adequately portray the extent of it gets lost in a two-dimensional television screen. So it is overwhelming, but it was also a pretty good motivator to me to figure out what I was going to do and not take a lot of time doing it.
So the decisions early on, when you talk about essentially trying to get a unity of government or a whole of government response, after seeing what it was that you were confronting, can you give us some details of sort of just how do you do that? I mean, literally, like, you call someone and say, come here, and or you people start talking to each other. I think for people who don't know how disaster management works, how do you assert the authority to essentially fix it?
Well, when you're looking at a complex response like this, the first thing I think about is command and control and communications, because without that, you lose the glue. So after I had talked to Mike Brown on the morning of the 6th of September at the Emergency Operations Center in Baton Rouge, he was getting ready to locate to a joint field office in an old Dillard's warehouse in central Baton Rouge, and they had been operating out of command and control trailers that had been deployed by FEMA out of their Denton, Texas office. And so on my way out the door, I said, what are you going to do with all this stuff when you move to the joint field office? And he said, I guess we'll take it back to Denton. And I said, well, I'd like to have these for New Orleans, because I knew when I got down there, I had to have capability to communicate, coordinate if I was going to be effective. That became a critical decision because that allowed us to communicate with the other entities who were down there. It gave us satellite communications and the ability to have planning spaces and to be able to link up with Russ Honore's forces, who was leading Joint Task Force Katrina. But to give you an idea of the problem, once I arrived there and I was at the landing zone outside the convention center, I looked down the street in front of the convention center, which is basically a four-lane road with a median in the middle, and the two lanes on the inside closest to the convention center were covered with 2 to 3 feet of garbage and refuse and things that had come out of the convention center. That was a pretty disturbing sight. But what you had around New Orleans at the time were pockets of people trying to do the best they could. They had established a makeshift law enforcement coordination center for the folks that had been deployed down there from other law enforcement agencies. There was a covered overhang outside the Harris Casino at the foot of where Poydras and Canal Street meet. And under that big overhang, which is where normally the people would come in to be dropped off to go into the casino, because there was no power or air conditioning, they had used that big shaded area as a place to put a command and control node. So all the law enforcement officers in town were kind of coordinating there to figure out what they were going to do to try and assist the city. But they were doing that based on their own initiative, and they were organizing themselves. I was told that I needed to go out to Zephyr Field to see what was going on out there. So Zephyr Field is a minor league baseball park to the west of New Orleans. It's also where the New Orleans Saints conduct their training. There's a large indoor facility for training and a stadium, so there's a lot of big space out there. And what had happened, a lot of the first responders that had come to New Orleans, and remember I said they were self-deployed, there was no central command and control, they had found each other and aggregated all their forces together, put it at Zephyr Field, and then created an incident command system where every day they were methodically applying the resources within the area they could get to, and they basically created what I had tried to do for the entire city ultimately, but they had done that on their own because they were capable and competent to do that, but they were operating within a certain radius. They weren't covering the whole area that needed to be covered. So the challenge was to take those disparate centers of excellence of resources and capability that could do something and link them all together and then address the entire city in terms of dividing it into sectors and attacking it on a coordinated basis.
So what you're describing, it seems like that there were sort of obviously horrible responses or insufficient responses, but that there were gems of really powerful and effective response capabilities, and that your job essentially was to, you know, create the necklace amongst all those gems.
That's correct. And frankly, I'm not doing this justice because there were so many people down there that were doing this. If you were actually to get on ground and walk around down there, you'd be very, very proud of what happened that first week. If you went over to the West Bank around Algiers, there were, I remember going to one, I think it was an elementary school, and all the local fire departments that had deployed down there aggregated together to produce their own, you know, node where they could operate from. But again, they were trying to figure out, where do I need to go, who needs help, and how do I do that? That's what had to be knitted together.
So how do you knit it together, right? I mean, this is the challenge, is that there's so many people doing so many different things, trying to save lives, trying to stop the levees, trying to get people to safety, throwing them into shelters, going to the Superdome. There's just no sort of center. So the challenge wasn't just negligence, which of course was occurring. It was actually just so much activity that needed to be managed and understood. And Thad Allen moves quickly. He often says that he had no learning curve during Hurricane Katrina, and he's probably right.
I think we probably stabilized the response operations in about 24 to 36 hours. And by response operations, I mean understanding the nature of the problem, being able to deploy forces when we were cued that there was a problem, and work in an integrated fashion with the military forces from U.S. Northern Command, the National Guard from Louisiana that was called up, and the other forces that were provided in the area. So I would say by about midday Wednesday, early Thursday, we had gotten into a routine or battle rhythm or cadence on planning, meetings, informing the city, and actually executing. And at the same time, they were beginning to repair the levees and the flood canal walls so that the city could be pumped out. We ultimately would do two more sweeps of the city in the same fashion to make sure we had not left anybody out, and then start the really difficult issue of remains recovery. So what happened was, on Friday morning, I got a call from Secretary Chertoff, who was in Baton Rouge, and he asked me to come up and meet with him. And he called me into an office, and he said, here's the situation. We're going to have a news conference in 30 minutes. You're going to relieve Mike Brown of the entire response, become the principal federal official for the entire coastline, which at that point, Florida had been impacted. Yeah. And there was significant damage in Alabama, Mississippi, Louisiana. And ultimately, when Rita came ashore, you know, Texas would be impacted as well. And so as of Friday, I think that would be like the 9th of September, I assume, the overall role of principal federal official.
In short, this is how Mike Brown got fired.
Well, you know, the secretary said, I want you to take over this, and I didn't object to that.
I'm going to take a brief pause here just to explain and remind people of the politics of the time as well. While Thad Allen is dealing with the disaster response, there's this whole interplay of politics going on that impact what he is and isn't able to do. For one, Mayor Ray Nagin at the time and Governor Blanco are not sort of disaster management, emergency management experts, and they are overwhelmed publicly and say so. They are overwhelmed by the catastrophe before them. At the same time, President Bush is sitting in D.C. talking to his lawyers about what can be done to move more national resources over to Louisiana and New Orleans and any of the other states. And the question they're asking themselves in the Situation Room or in the Oval Office is this: should the federal government, should the national government, should the White House essentially take over and send in the literal troops? This is a complicated legal issue, and lawyers are probably going to not like how simplistic I'm making it sound. But the law does permit a president to send in national troops in the case of an insurrection. So remember the civil rights movement and the desegregation movement when the troops were sent into Little Rock, for example. And so the Bush lawyers were actually saying, well, this is akin to something like that, that there's no local or state government that's functioning. It's like an insurrection. Let's send in the troops. And Bush balked at that for a variety of reasons. And playing over this is the sort of also racial dynamics between an African-American city and essentially an all-white White House. There are the dynamics of a female governor and a male president. And all of those are playing out quite publicly in the newspapers at the time. And ultimately, President Bush decides not to do it, to try to support local and state efforts, however negligible they are at that stage. And later on in his memoir, he says, after everything during his presidency, including the war in Iraq, he actually says this is his one greatest regret, that he did not send in the troops. And he regrets that. But it sounds like maybe that wouldn't have changed anything.
Well, we don't know, because we don't know what would have happened if decisions had been made earlier, say before the convention center and the Superdome issues. Yeah. My feeling is that if you resolve the problem, you can resolve the problem one way or the other. You can create the capability and capacity for the city and the state to carry out their legal responsibilities, or you can do that anyway with the resources you have. I thought it was my duty, because I had actually had discussions with legal folks in the week leading up to my deployment down there, because everybody was interested in what was going on. Mm. You know, should we invoke the Insurrection Act? Should we waive posse comitatus? And the fact of the matter was, at least to the people I talked to, and I'm not a legal expert, there was not sufficient cause to preempt a standing mayor and a governor and do anything other than what we did. So the question is, based on the legal framework at the time when I arrived, how do you make it work? And you can think about what you might have done. But the other alternative was, if you understood that they had lost continuity of government, and that's what the real problem was. It wasn't a hurricane, then a disaster declaration. If you'd understood that and acted, you know, within the first 24 or 36 hours, could you have moved the organizational construct we created a week later to the left on a timeline and basically preempted what might have happened in the Superdome or the Convention Center? You know, and I think it's up to debate.
So you are there. And as a leader, I mean, I've heard you say that you had to lead from everywhere, that, you know, just essentially everyone needs someone to organize, plan, and make decisions. And for you personally, you had no learning curve. I mean, this is, you're just sort of, I don't want to say thrown into it. You had a tremendous career, but there is no template to deal with something like this, the greatest natural disaster, over 1,000 killed or dead. I'm sort of asking just personally, like, what was that like day to day with no capacity for mistake, and a city and a state and a nation looking to you to just, you know, with the simple mandate, fix it?
Well, I think there are a couple of aspects to this. I think, first of all, you have to start with transparency. I wasn't sure whether we would succeed or not, but from the outset, when I was talking to the press or to the people in and around the region that were affected, I kept telling them my job is to cut through red tape, increase the velocity of the response, you know, do away with bureaucratic layers, start having effects. And that was just a general statement of purpose. And then when you find specific examples where you can make something happen, you would do it. Most of the time, the problems were related to the lack of all the parties understanding, number one, what were the applicable laws and statutes, what were the resources available. And once you understand what the, what all the components are, then you can have a reasoned discussion about what your options are and what you should do. But the framework to actually assess that and have that discussion was what was missing for over a week.
So I want to ask you now, looking 10 years later, with the capacity of hindsight, which can be blinding or illuminating depending on where you are at the moment. But I want to ask you, sir, when you look back, what's the single thing you wish you had done differently?
Well, I think I'm not sure I had an adequate appreciation of the complexity of the organizational structure. I'm just talking about inside the federal government mm-hmm. now and what it would take to kind of coordinate this. And that includes the different operating programs inside FEMA. And then this notion of how you actually conduct a response and deal with an emergency and how you shift to long-term recovery. I ended up being down there for 6 months. Mm-hmm. The response portion of my duties ended in a matter of weeks, except for when we had a second hurricane when Rita came ashore in eastern Texas and southwest Louisiana. The thing that was new for me that I had to kind of work through is how you start sorting out what is near-term emergency and response and how you start shifting to longer-term sustainment, because you can put somebody in an emergency shelter. Well, first of all, if somebody's wet, they want to be dry. Once they're dry, they're thirsty and they want to be fed. Once they've been fed and they're not thirsty, they want a place to sleep, and you keep going up Maslow's hierarchy of needs. But at some point, you have to start looking at what are the long-term solution, and over 200,000 units of housing were lost. Over 1 million people were evacuated. The enormity of that situation even dwarfed the capabilities and capacities that FEMA had at the time, and trying to work through that complexity was probably the most challenging part of it. I was pretty much used to conducting operations, and I had to conduct some large-scale search and rescue operations, obviously, not that large, but it was something I was familiar with and what I knew. Trying to deal with how we transition from a response to recovery, though, that was probably the most complex part of this thing.
So there must have been a moment in this, 10-day period, 1 month period, 6 month period, where you could say to yourself, it's not perfect. Could have done better here, might have come faster there, but I've got grip over this. And do you remember when that moment came? Was there just an incident in which you just thought in your head, in the midst of this horror, I'm seeing a light at the end of this tunnel?
I think the turning point, the last big hurdle on the response side, which led me to believe that we need to start thinking about a transition to recovery, was when we were able to actually create the capability and capacity to handle the remains that we were finding and deal with them with dignity. And make sure that we treated everybody with respect. And the problem there was, as you noted, the casualties were in the thousands. At one point, they thought there might be 5,000 or 10,000 casualties. God knows we were lucky that didn't happen. But in the state of Louisiana, there was no large-scale laboratory for DNA testing. There wasn't a robust state medical examiner function. So we basically had to build a medical examiner capability, a morgue, and a place to actually do that. And it did not exist before the storm. And what we did was we actually, in the town of St. Gabriel, which is south of Baton Rouge, in a matter of days, we built a base camp around an empty grade school There was a big playground next to it where we had to do the grim task. We had been collecting remains, but there was an issue of how do we ultimately do the proper examination of the remains, try and connect them with DNA samples, and how do we treat these people with dignity and respect. In the meantime, we had taken refrigerated trailers, and we had needed a place to actually store them. So they were on the playgrounds adjacent to the elementary school. And then there was a warehouse across the street that inside the warehouse, we put in a big medical tent that we could pressurize and create the proper medical boundaries so we could go ahead and proceed with the medical examination work that had to be done. I have to tell you, the creation of that in such a short period of time without a pre-existing infrastructure was nothing short of extraordinary. And some of the people that I had the most respect for visiting down there, and I had great respect for everybody, but the people that were involved in actually dealing with those remains, making the identifications, dealing with the families, those were some very special people working under some extraordinarily difficult conditions. When we had done that, I felt it was time to look at long-term recovery, and that's when I started thinking about what is the exit criteria by which I should present to Secretary Chertoff and have me succeeded by somebody that could focus on long-term recovery.
In some ways, the response to Hurricane Katrina was not just about, you know, getting wet people dry and getting dry people fed. It was it became bigger. It became a disaster about urban policy and systemic poverty and racism and corrupt police departments, and fixing New Orleans became bigger than the hurricane itself. And that seems like a tremendous pressure on a disaster management system. Did you feel that when you were there? And how can you, you know, sort of set the conditions of success? Because ending systemic poverty or systemic racism, you know, is not something FEMA or the Coast Guard is sort of equipped to do.
I believe, in fact, I believe very strongly, and I passed this on to the folks who were doing lessons learned after Katrina, and I think we saw it after Sandy as well. We need a clear-cut policy framework for moving from a response structure to a long-term recovery structure. I think there should be some set period of time, and just for the sake of argument, let's say 90 days after an event, FEMA should be out of the housing business. That should go to HUD, and FEMA should be reloading for the next emergency. We still don't have our arms around how to make that transition happen in government. Regarding your comments on local social conditions, I was asked at a press conference when I was down there at one point whether or not there were any social equity issues that were involved in the response, and I kind of separated it out into two different answers to the question. The first one was, when you've got a rescue swimmer dangling from the end of a hoist cable with a chainsaw cutting through an attic to find people that are trapped calling from a cell phone, nobody is worried about ethnicity, income level, or anything else at that point. You're just trying to save people's lives. That said, and this is an overstatement of the obvious, the event does not create the preconditions. And to the extent that preconditions exist that erode resiliency and your ability to deal with the problem, you're going to have consequences of greater effect and greater magnitude. And I think in different aspects, that's probably what was present in New Orleans. I've said many, many times since then, in my view, we should treat resiliency, and clear to the national level, national resiliency is something akin to the human immune system. If you've got a strong immune system and you get sick, you get through that process more quickly and you get on with the rest of your life. To the extent that you have concentrated populations, high-rise buildings, transportation systems that are not efficient to get people out, and other conditions that impede the ability for a population to be compliant with directions of their elected leaders, you're going to have aggravated consequences associated with that. And so when we're looking at national resiliency, we need to be looking at the implications of issues related to how we live, what's important to us, the priorities we make, because those all come into play on how resilient or immune a community is to dealing with one of these events.
In short, well before Hurricane Katrina, New Orleans with high crime and high poverty rates, with city government not functioning, being corrupt, with its inability to provide the basic social services to its majority African American population, In short, well before Hurricane Katrina, New Orleans was already broken. Like 6 months is a long time to be the center point person for a disaster and a tragedy like Hurricane Katrina. And, you know, as a leader, you must have acquired skills that help you deal with that kind of stress and pressure and essentially writing off your real life for half a year. What did you do mentally, emotionally, to just brace yourself for a long haul like this?
Well, I've been asked that question a lot since the event, and I firmly believe that despite having super supportive subordinates, a cadre of people around that you trust that are supporting you, and bosses that are really behind you, and I had all of that working for me down there, there are times because of the exigency of the situation, you have to make decisions under conditions of uncertainty. There are times when you just basically have to manage your own morale. And I link this back to a discussion that I've had with several people about a lifelong dedication to leadership as a craft and emotional intelligence. You know, it took me a long time to come to grips with what made me mad, what made me emotional. Unless you really understand that, you can't create a discipline to say, I'm going to check that off right now until I get some space where I can think about it myself and focus on what I've got to do. So I think this notion of having a larger conversation as part of leadership training, having to do with emotional intelligence, the ability to empathize and kind of order what you've got to do and be able to say, I'm going to check my feelings at the door until I get this done, because if I don't, this is not going to happen. And there are times where, you know, you can be more contemplative and be off by yourself and kind of deal with it. It's not, you know, it's not always easy to do, but if you don't develop that self-discipline, you're not going to be able to focus on what you need to do. I also believe that, and this has less to do with me down there and what I've told folks that have been under stress that have worked for me in the past. At the time you're most at risk professionally, personally, physically, that's the time that you are most consequential to the people that work for you and who you work for. And if you really think about that, you can turn it around and make this a positive, you know, almost an adrenaline driver for you, in that you have an extraordinary opportunity to demonstrate by your behavior who you are and what you stand for.
So in disaster management, or in almost any event, once the event is done, you know, in quotes that it's done, there's a lot of effort on memorializing and teaching and training around lessons learned. So now looking back 10 years, how has government changed because of Hurricane Katrina? And I guess a little bit less optimistically, what lessons have we not learned or unlearned?
I think the big one for me is a better understanding of what I would call the interaction between the natural environment and the built environment. We need to do a better job of creating what I would call environmental intelligence. You know, for a number of years, they've been trying to undo things that were decided for flood control in the Everglades that they found out were injurious to the environment. I think the big takeaway from Hurricane Katrina is the interaction of decisions made on how man was going to build infrastructure to facilitate commerce, vis-a-vis understanding the natural environment, how they interacted with each other. I don't think there's even a close second. The lesson we learned from this is that we make good decisions, but they're based on the information we have at the time and the pressures of economics and public policy and so forth, and the whole issue of how we've managed the central Mississippi River Basin in this country and all the water issues associated with it, I think, is the number one issue.
So right now we're hearing a lot about New Orleans and its 10-year recovery. How is it doing? How are the schools? How is poverty? How is the employment rates? Where is New Orleans today? But we do need to take a look back at what happened during the darkest days of Hurricane Katrina. And we could get bogged down in the operational responses and talks of unity of effort and how much, you know, national resources should be sent and President Bush's decisions or Governor Blanco's decisions. But ultimately, as Thad Allen described in these last few moments, it comes down to just being human, to feel empathy and understand what is going on in the communities that our governments are meant to protect. And that means getting your feet and your knees and your thighs wet and heading to the floods of New Orleans. So there's a lot to learn here, and that's probably a good thing because, as we know, in the country and the world that we live in, there will be more disasters. In fact, Thad Allen and I got to know each other very well when I was tasked to work with him on the BP oil spill just 5 years after Hurricane Katrina. There, oil gushed from the ocean floor, and yet again, a president calls Thad Allen and says, "Fix this." Thad is now retired from federal government, but what he did during Hurricane Katrina, just to put some grip over the response efforts, will not be forgotten. Next time, I'm going to be talking to Peter Neffinger, the new head of the Transportation Security Administration, and you can bet I am going to ask him why I still have to take off my shoes every time I get on an airplane. You can subscribe to the Security Mom podcast in iTunes, and while you're there, please rate and review. It makes it easier for people to find us. We have links to Stitcher and iTunes and SoundCloud, and we'll be posting all of our episodes on our website. That's wgbhnews.org/securitymom. And you can reach me at securitymom@wgbh.org, and you can find me on Twitter at Juliet Kayyem. That's K-A-Y-Y-E-M. Security Mom is a production of WGBH News. Our producer is Mary Dew, and special thanks to Dion Lefkowitz and Sam Medeiros. I'm Juliet Kayyem.